TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. David Ray Griffin, 9/11 and the American Empire. When the theologian David Ray Griffin spoke at the University of Madison, Wisconsin in April 2005, C-SPAN had sent a camera. To everybody's surprise, they broadcast his talk right away. Viewers to mainstream TV heard Professor Griffin explain why he believes that the Bush administration not only knew in advance about the events of 9/11, but had a hand in bringing them about. David Ray Griffin retired in 2004 from the Claremont School of Theology, where he had taught for 30 years. After publishing over 20 books on theology, he wrote in 2004 The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. On 214 pages, he compiled research on the literally hundreds of unanswered questions around 9/11. His research received high praise from historian Howard Zinn. Even though his book was not reviewed in the mainstream media, it became an instant international bestseller with over 100,000 copies sold. When the 9/11 Commission completed its work, Griffin wrote his second book entitled The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. David Ray Griffin was invited to the University of Madison by the Muslim-Jewish-Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth. Here is Professor David Ray Griffin.
It's my first time to University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've always heard this is an extraordinary place. But now I see it's like that town in a neighboring state here where everybody is good-looking and far above average. The title of my talk tonight is 9/11 and the American Empire, How Should Religious People Respond? I will begin by unpacking those three terms, 9/11, American Empire, and religious people, starting with the third. Although I am a Christian theologian, I am in this talk addressing religious people in general. I am doing so because I believe that religious people should respond to 9/11 and the American Empire in a particular way because of the moral principles of their religious tradition that are common to all the historic religious traditions. I have in mind principles such as, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's oil. Thou shalt not murder thy neighbors in order to steal their oil. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbors, accusing them of illicitly harboring weapons of mass destruction in order to justify killing them to steal their oil. This language is, of course, language that we associate with the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But the same basic ideas can be found in other religious traditions. I turn now to the term American Empire, which has been a highly contentious term. In his 2002 book, American Empire, Andrew Bacevich points out that it was long a cherished American tradition that the United States is not and cannot be an empire. The words American Empire, he adds, were fighting words, so that uttering them was almost a sure sign that one was a left-wing critic of American foreign policy. But as Bacevich also points out, this has all recently changed, so that now even right-wing commentators freely acknowledge the existence of the American Empire. As columnist Charles Krauthammer said in 2002, people are coming out of the closet on the word empire. this new frankness often includes an element of pride, as exemplified by Krauthammer's statement that America is no mere international citizen, but the dominant power in the world, more dominant than any since Rome. Given this consensus about the reality of the American Empire, the only remaining matter of debate concerns its nature. The new frankness about the American Empire by conservatives is generally accompanied by portrayals of it as benign. Robert Kagan has written of the benevolent empire. Dinesh D'Souza, after writing in 2002 that America has become an empire, added that happily, it is the most magnanimous imperial power ever. Krauthammer says, the fact that America's claim to being a benign power is not mere self-congratulation, is shown by its track record. Commentators from the left, however, have a radically different view. A recent book by Noam Chomsky is subtitled America's Quest for Global Dominance. Richard Falk has written of the Bush administration's global domination project, which poses the threat, he says, of global fascism. Chalmers Johnson was once a conservative who believed that American foreign policy aimed at promoting freedom and democracy. But he now describes the United States as a military juggernaut intent on world domination. Andrew Bacevich is another conservative who has recently changed his mind. Unlike Johnson, he has not come to identify with the left, but he has come to agree with its assessment of the American empire. He now ridicules the claim that the promotion of peace, democracy, and human rights, and the punishment of evildoers, not the pursuit of self-interest, has defined the essence of American diplomacy. Pointing out that the aim of the U.S. military has been to achieve something approaching omnipotence, Bacevich mocks the idea that such power in America's hands is by definition benign. If the American empire is interpreted in different ways, the same is true all the more so for the term 9/11. For those Americans who accept the official interpretation, 9/11 was a surprise attack on the U.S. government and its people by Islamic terrorists. For some Americans, 9/11 has a more complex meaning. This second group, while accepting the official interpretation of the attacks, thinks of 9/11 primarily as an event that was used opportunistically by the Bush administration to extend the American empire. This interpretation is effectively presented by writers such as Noam Chomsky, Rahul Mahajan, and Chalmers Johnson. For a third group of Americans, the name 9/11 connotes an event with a more sinister dimension. These citizens believe that the Bush administration knew the attacks were coming and intentionally let them happen. Although no national poll has been taken to ascertain how many Americans in general hold this view, a Zogby poll in New York surprisingly indicated that almost half of the residents of New York City held that view. According to a fourth view of 9/11, the attacks were not merely foreknown by the Bush administration, they were orchestrated by it. Although thus far no poll has tried to find out how many Americans hold this view, polls in Canada and Germany taken some time back indicated that this view was already held by 15 to 20% of their people. Religious people who take the moral principles of their religious tradition seriously will probably have very different attitudes about the American empire depending on which of these four views they hold. If they accept the official view, according to which America was the innocent victim of evil terrorists, then it is easy for them to think of America's so-called war on terror as a just war. This is the position taken by Jean Bethke Elstein, a professor of ethics at the University of Chicago's Divinity School, in a book called Just War Against Terror. From this perspective, the war on terror has nothing to do with imperial designs. It is simply a war to save the world from evil terrorists. Second interpretation of 9/11, according to which the Bush administration cynically exploited the 9/11 attacks to further its imperial plans, has quite different implications. Although it thinks of the attacks as surprise attacks, planned entirely by external enemies of America, it regards these attacks as blowback for injustices perpetrated by U.S. imperialism. This second view typically regards the American response to the attacks of 9/11 as far worse than the attacks themselves. They've already led to hundreds of thousands of deaths. This interpretation of 9/11 would lead people who take their religion's moral principles seriously to support a movement to change U.S. foreign policy. An even stronger reaction would be evoked by the third interpretation, for it entails that the Bush administration allowed thousands of its own citizens to be killed on 9/11, deliberately and cold-bloodedly, for the sake of advancing its imperial interests, and then used this event as an excuse to kill hundreds of thousands of people in other lands, while hypocritically portraying itself as promoting a culture of life. Of course, those who accept the previous interpretation know that hypocrisy with regard to the sanctity of life has long been a feature of official U.S. rhetoric. And yet most Americans, if they learned that their government had deliberately let their own citizens be killed, would surely consider this betrayal qualitatively different. For this would be treason, a betrayal of the oath taken by American political leaders to protect their own citizens. If this third view implies that the Bush administration is guilty of a heinous and even treasonous crime, this is all the more the case with the fourth view. For many Americans, the idea that we are living in a country whose own leaders planned and carried out the attacks of 9/11 is simply too horrible to entertain. Unfortunately, however, there is considerable evidence for this view. And if we find this evidence convincing, the implications for resistance to the U.S. empire building project are radical. As Bacevich has emphasized, the only remaining debate about the American empire is whether it is benign. The interpretation of 9/11 is relevant to this debate because it would be very difficult to accept either the third or the fourth interpretation and still consider American imperialism benign. So I now turn to some of the evidence that supports these views. I will look first at evidence that supports at least the third view, according to which U.S. officials had foreknowledge of the attacks. A central aspect of the official story about 9/11 is that the attacks were planned entirely by Al-Qaeda, with no one else knowing the plans. A year after the attacks, FBI Director Robert Mueller said, "To this day, we have found no one in the United States except the actual hijackers who knew of the plot." Since that time, federal officials have had to admit that they had received far more warnings prior to 9/11 than they had previously acknowledged. But these admissions, while raising the question of why further safety measures were not in place do not necessarily show that the federal officials had specific foreknowledge of the attacks. One could still, as the 9/11 Commission did, accept the conclusion published at the end of the 2002 Congressional Joint Inquiries Report, which said that none of the intelligence gathered by the U.S. intelligence community identified the time, place, and specific nature of the attacks that were planned for September 11, 2001. Unfortunately for the official account, however, there are reports indicating that federal officials did have that very specific kind of information. I will give two examples. The first example involves Attorney David Shippers, who had been the chief prosecutor for the impeachment of President Clinton. 2 days after 9/11, Shippers declared that he had received warnings from FBI agents about the attacks 6 weeks earlier, warnings that included both the dates and the targets. These agents had come to him, Shippers said, because FBI headquarters had blocked their investigations and had threatened them with prosecution if they went public with their information. So they asked Shippers to use his influence to get the government to take action to prevent the attacks. And Shippers, surely, as the prosecutor of Clinton, should have had influence in Republican circles. And yet he reports that he tried to contact Attorney General Ashcroft, and Ashcroft repeatedly refused to return his calls. Shippers' allegations about the FBI agents were then corroborated in a story by William Norman Grigg called Did We Know What Was Coming?, which was published in The New American, a conservative magazine. According to Grigg, three FBI agents he interviewed told him that the information provided to Shippers was widely known within the FBI before September 11th. If Shippers, Grigg, and these agents are telling the truth, it would seem that when FBI Director Mueller claimed that the FBI had found no one in this country with advanced knowledge of the plot, he was not telling the truth. The government also would have had foreknowledge of the attacks because of an extraordinarily high volume of put options purchased in the 3 days before 9/11. To buy put options for a particular company is to bet that its stock price is going to go down. These purchases were for two and only two airlines, American and United, the two airlines whose planes were used in the attacks, and also for Morgan Stanley Dean Witter, which occupied 22 stories of the World Trade Center. The price of these shares did, of course, plummet after 9/11. As the San Francisco Chronicle said, these unusual purchases, which resulted in profits of at least tens of millions of dollars, raised suspicions that the investors had advanced knowledge of the strikes. For our purposes, the most important implication of this story follows from the fact that U.S. intelligence agencies monitor the market, looking for signs of imminent untoward events. These extraordinary purchases, therefore, would have suggested to intelligence agencies that in the next few days, United and American airliners were going to be used in attacks on the World Trade Center. That is fairly specific knowledge. These two examples then imply the falsity of the joint inquiry statement that none of the intelligence gathered by the U.S. intelligence community identified the time, place, and specific nature of the attacks. Indeed, one of the FBI agents interviewed by William Grigg said, Obviously, people had to know. It's terrible to think this, but this must have been allowed to happen as part of some other agenda. He was right. This would be terrible. There is considerable evidence, however, that the full truth is even more terrible. That the reason some officials had foreknowledge of the attacks is because they had planned them. The evidence for this fourth view consists of features of the attacks in conjunction with behavior of U.S. officials that cannot be explained on the assumption that the attacks were planned and executed entirely by foreign agents. I will give four examples. One feature of the attacks that suggests complicity by U.S. officials is the twofold fact that the U.S. military failed to stop the attacks on 9/11, and that then, since then, they have given us three different stories as to why they failed. These changing stories suggest that the military has been trying to cover up the fact that a stand-down order was given on 9/11, canceling the military's own standard operating procedures for dealing with hijacked airplanes. It is certainly clear that some agency, either the military or the FAA, failed to follow standard procedures on 9/11. When these procedures are followed, the FAA, as soon as it sees signs that a plane may have been hijacked, calls military officials, who then call the nearest Air Force base with fighters on alert, telling it to send up a couple of fighters to intercept the plane. Such interceptions usually occur within 10 to 20 minutes after the first sign of trouble. This is a routine procedure happening about 100 times a year. If you've read the story in Popular Mechanics, you know, one of their big lies is, oh, gee, there's only been one such interception in the last several years. No, it's a routine procedure about 100 times a year. On 9/11, however, it did not happen. Why not? The military's first story was that no planes were sent up until after the Pentagon was hit. The military leaders were admitting, therefore, that they had left their fighters on the ground for almost 90 minutes after the FAA had first noticed signs of a possible hijacking. This first story suggested to many people that a stand-down order must have been given. By the end of the week, the military had put out a second story, saying that it had sent up fighters, but that because the FAA had been very late in notifying it about the hijackings, the fighters arrived too late in each case. One problem with this story is if the FAA personnel had responded so slowly, heads should have rolled, but none did. An even more serious problem is that even assuming the truth of the late notification times, the military's fighters still had time to intercept the hijacked airliners before they were to hit their targets. The second story implied, therefore, that standard procedures had been violated by the military as well as by the FAA. To try to defend the military against this accusation, the 9/11 Commission report gave us a third story, according to which the FAA, after giving the military insufficient warning about the first hijacked airline, gave it absolutely no warning about the other three until after they had crashed. But as I have pointed out in my second book on 9/11, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, this account is wholly implausible. Besides portraying the FAA personnel from top to bottom as incompetent, bumbling dolts, the 9/11 Commission's account rests on claims that contradict many credible and mutually supporting testimonies. In some of these cases, the fact that the commission is simply lying is obvious. In addition, this third story implies that the military's second story, which it had been telling for almost 3 years, was almost entirely false. So if our military leaders were lying to us all that time, why should we believe them now? And if our military is lying to us, must we not assume that it is doing so to cover up its own guilt? In sum, the behavior of the military, both on 9/11 and afterwards, combined with the fact that the 9/11 Commission had to resort to lies to make the U.S. military appear blameless, suggests that U.S. military leaders were complicit in the attacks.
That was the first half of a one-hour talk by the theologian David Ray Griffin, entitled 9/11 and the American Empire, How Should Religious People Respond? Come back for part two, where David Ray Griffin presents more evidence of official involvement in 9/11. You will also hear how the events of 9/11 have been used in the context of U.S. empire building. From Brzezinski's Grand Chessboard, the project for the new American century, to Rumsfeld's plans to weaponize space, Griffin proves in part two how all these plans of empire building link to the events of 9/11. You also heard the clock tower chimes atop Bascom Hill, right across the street from the lecture hall where Griffin spoke. You can find out more about David Ray Griffin on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour talk on 9/11 and the American Empire by calling us. A footnoted 31-page transcript and a film of the talk on DVD are also available. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD or DVD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.